Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This Eastern Standard Holiday Special is an hour of selected features from our ongoing series, Humans of Central Appalachia, photographer and videographer Malcolm Wilson's collection of Appalachian voices, people sharing life in the mountains as they know it and live it. We begin with
Ronnie Walker.
A lifelong resident of Harlan, Ronnie worked for 28 years at the Pineville Hospital as a licensed practical nurse, retiring in 2014.
I've been busy ever since, though.
And we'll get into what's keeping Ronnie Walker busy in just a moment, but first, some history.
I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, and so they say it takes a village. Well, truly, it was like that. We had our boundaries. But we also knew that anyone in that neighborhood had the authority to tell us what we could and couldn't do.
This was in the early racially segregated 60s.
Come up in a time where you had the black waiting rooms, where you had to sit in the back of the bus. When they decided to build another pool, the blacks got the pool on Elm Street, which was actually bigger than the pool that they built, replaced it. So you had black kids swimming over on Elm Street, and then the white kids. And then we had white people there that we played with, but, you know. So it wasn't so out there, but it was here. We were allowed to go in the restaurants, but we couldn't sit down. But we could order our food, but we couldn't sit down. We had to take it out somewhere. But it was so routine that, you know, you just never thought about it. You just said, this is the way it is.
Until it no longer was. Ronnie had been attending Rosenwald High School.
It was the black school here in town.
When integration came to Harlan.
We started out at Rosenwald in the ninth grade for 1 week. And then they said, you got to go to this other school. And so they just dropped us down there. We didn't know anybody. We didn't know the school. We didn't know anything.
And it was scary.
Because we didn't get to go to tour the school. We didn't know where our homerooms were, our teachers, or anything like that.
It was a culture shock.
Because I went from a school that discipline was one of the number one things to a school that sometimes anything goes. So it was like strange because some of the things we saw the other kids do, we were like, we would not have been allowed to do that. One of my instructors, I remember her saying, she says, integration is good. She said, but it's maybe going to ruin the black kids. And I asked her why, and she said, because I've never seen any more malleable children than came from down here. And so, and as years went by, I saw what it did do because I thought, well, if they can do that, I can do that. And so some of the kids that came up after me, they sort of forgot what they were taught.
So what is keeping Ronnie Walker busy these days? Well, for one thing, Harlan's Higher Ground Theater.
I like the challenge of doing something I've never done before. And I'm not one of those that always steps outside the comfort zone, but with Higher Ground, I'm able to do a lot of things like, if I do public speaking, I get really, really nervous. But when I'm on stage, I don't get nervous because I'm someone else.
And life in the mountains?
I love these mountains.
And I love the people here.
You're listening to an Eastern Standard Holiday Special, selected features from our Humans of Central Appalachia series, based on the voices of the region among the more than 400, recorded by photographer, videographer Malcolm Wilson. Our next stop, Cumberland, Kentucky, for a visit with Brittany Boggs.
I'm your typical coal miner's daughter, and I got a twin brother, so I was one of the boys. I was never bored. He's my best friend. To this day, he's my best friend.
Brittany is a single mom of three with a day job that she loves.
I'm a registered nurse. I've worked at the Harlan Hospital for 7.5 years.
So what was it like growing up in the mountains of eastern Kentucky?
Oh, man. There's nothing like it. We might have crammed a bowl of fruity pebbles down our throats, and then out the door we went. it. We were in the mountains, the creeks, from daylight till dark. That was life.
Good memories of high school.
Bonfires and trail riding, football games. I was a softball player. I was switching a cheerleading type. I liked softball. That was my thing.
And home was great.
I had the most wonderful parents ever. If it wasn't for them, I couldn't make it.
From high school on to Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College to pursue that career in nursing.
Because I love to take care of people. I just always have. There's nothing like it.
But ask Brittany what she loves most, more than anything in the world, it's those three kids.
I was washing dishes. Caden comes through the house screaming, "She got it, she got it, she got her first one." And I'm like, I didn't hear a gunshot. Oh my God, what did she get? You know, him and Angel was out here playing. I said, "What do you mean she got her first one, son?" Well, I cut the corner and a tree was laying through the house.
A tree?
She cut her first tree down when she was about 6 years old.
They brought it to the house.
And drug it in the front door. And it was laid across the living room so that to make Mama proud, I guess.
And then there are the critters.
We got all kinds of critters. We got a turkey right now. Her name's Missy. We got two ducks, Quacky and Splashy. We got a couple of hens. Our hens don't have names. They're just hens. We got a rabbit named Bigfoot.
And the bear that pays visits and why she keeps a bear kit handy.
My bear kit, yes, it's actually in the door of my car. My bear kit consists of some firecrackers and some matches. I have a bear kit because I have a bear, which we've named Yogi. And Yogi comes down, he used to come, he's eased up now since we got the dog.
Yeah.
He used to come every morning, he'd sit right there and look at us. So yeah, bears, they're pretty, but they kind of scare me.
As a coal miner's daughter, mine closings trouble Brittany, and drugs.
I think a big part of it is, you know, there's nothing for young people or children to do. Once they get out of high school, that's really it. I mean, you have to drive 25 miles to go to Walmart, you know?
But Brittany Boggs will not be joining the exodus of young adults from the region.
Because I love the mountains. It's home. They're beautiful. This is where I was born and raised.
And the people.
They're the sweetest, kindest people you'll ever meet. I really don't have any neighbors up here, but just for instance, at Mom and Dad's house, they go out of town, they don't have to worry about their health. When they come back, their neighbors can tell them everybody who knocked on the door, get their mail for them without being asked. If there's a death in the family, you know, people come help you clean your house, food. You have enough food to live a month off of.
Some might say it's a tough life.
I think it takes special people. I think God put special people here in these mountains. And we are tough, but in a sweet way. We work together, not just the family, but the community. Everybody pitches in, and we're taught at young ages to work. Hoeing, digging potatoes when we're 5 years old. There's just no place like home.
Brittany Boggs of Cumberland, Kentucky. You can find this and past episodes on our website at esweku.com. Click on the Humans of Central Appalachia tab. You're listening to an Eastern Standard Holiday retrospective of our series, Humans of Central Appalachia. Our next visit is with
Russell Huff
of Harlan, Kentucky.
I'm a tour guide and run an automotive parts store and a race car shop.
Tour guide?
I run a tour, Portal 31 in Lynch. It's a coal mine tour where we actually take the tourists inside of an actual coal mines for a 45-minute nonstop historical tour.
But this is the story of Russell Huff's early years growing up in Leslie County on Greasy Creek.
As 13 kids, we were mostly all born at home. And at the time that I was little, there was no road by our house. We lived on about 200-300 acres of land that we farmed with an old mule. And there was no income except for some kind of veteran's pension that Daddy had. And we raised probably cornfield a mile long, half a mile wide by hand. All of us kids hoeing the corn, plowing it with that old mule. We kept regular farm animals, chickens, goats, pigs, 10 or 11 pigs. They run wild, the hogs did. That's where the wild pigs got started, probably over in that part of the country. But we just rounded them up when we wanted them. We wanted to fatten them up. chickens run free too, over probably 30, it probably covered 30 acres of our property. They were all over the place.
This was not a city. It was not a town, not a village, not even a crossroads.
There was no road in front of the house. The road was in the river. There's a little creek called Greasy Creek. It was completely pure, clear, full fish. No mining, no run from the settlement school to hiding. And you could drink out of it, swim in it, play in it. And we ate fish out of it three times a week or four, all the time. And so it provided quite a bit of food.
Home was a clapboard, pine board, batten, tin roof, a big house. It needed to be to house Russell and his 12 brothers and sisters.
There was about four bedrooms, and we'd stack them up. The little kids would sleep four laying one way, three or four laying the other way. And then I'll get in there. And then as you got bigger and needed a little bit more privacy, two or three of older boys would share a room, individual beds. And the girls, of course, had the older girls had their own rooms.
The nearest store was 5 miles away.
And the only vehicle that ever went up and down through there, except for an occasional log truck, was an old Jeep that carried the mail up and down the riverbank. And if we wanted something, we would put a note in the mailbox with the money, like some pop or box of crackers or something. Yeah. And the mail lady would pick it up at the store and set it back to the mailbox. And we'd go over and get it. So we didn't leave the property much. It was just too much work to do.
Hard work. Strict parents.
You didn't never backtalk anybody. You get a switching.
No running water, no electricity. Long walks to and from school every day, whatever the weather.
I went to school at a little block, one-room school called Abner's Branch. And we walked around the side of the hill about a mile and a half. And there was no snow days. If it was a weekday, you went to school. School turned out back in April back in them days. And if you needed to stay home and work in the garden or something, that was okay too in springtime and even in the fall. So we walked to school, we walked home for lunch, and winter, summer, I remember my knees going up to the snow walking home from school. We'd walk home at 12, be back at 1, and then walk back at 3. We got an actual road up out of the river when I was about 8 years old, and we got a school bus when I was in the 7th grade.
And school buses would soon enough become a big part of Russell's life when they showed up.
We couldn't go to Leslie County High School. Like I said, there wasn't no road. So they arranged if we could somehow get to the Harlan County line, they brought us out of there to Kaywood High School. And sometimes the bus run up Leslie County. Sometimes we walked 4 or 5 miles. So we were up about 3:30 or 4. We caught the bus at the Harlan County line at 15 to 5. We got home at 15 to 7. We were riding 40 miles one way. We would ride to Green Hill, about 20 miles, 15 miles, switch out to another bus that come up from Pineville and ride on to Kaywood, and then do the same thing going home and hope that the Leslie County bus is waiting on us if it's pouring rain. If not, we walk.
It might sound like a hard life, and some might be tempted to make assumptions.
Used to, we were stereotyped as hillbillies and unintelligent and stuff like that.
But those doing the stereotyping would probably be surprised to learn how Russell and his brothers and sisters, isolated out there on Greasy Creek, Kentucky, spent their evenings.
Well, it was good compared to today's life. I guess if I'm going to make a comparison here, I had more time to read. I wrote a lot of poems, wrote a lot of short stories. It seemed like it was more peaceful back then. Nowadays, you got a cell phone that goes off 100 times a day. I very seldom get time to write poetry anymore. I do a little bit for one of my friends. They'll tick me off and I'll write them a little funny poem, you know. But back then I wrote constantly, and a couple times a month the teacher would load us all up that wanted to go or bring them to us and go to the Pine Mountain Library, and we would get books. And so we spent a lot of winter evenings reading. I've read every kind of book under the world, probably about 10,000, 15,000.
So, poems?
I could probably write one off for you. You want to hear it?
Well, sure.
All right, it's called The Gigolo.
Okay, we're ready.
If you come to my first date, we'll call her Patty. Who's that man? I think it's her daddy, but she got the money from the looks of that caddy. I'm just a poor man, can't pick and choose. Sell my soul for a living, got nothing to lose. But the bills piling up and rent's due. She pays for everything, even the food. I know it's not right. I know it's a sin. I'm living my life as a stepboyfriend.
So maybe Huff Daddy?
Ain't nobody talking to me. I sent that to my nephew's recording studio down in Nashville. He sent it back. We don't want that stuff here. Nashville's in bad enough shape.
Russell Huff of Harlan, Kentucky, another Eastern Kentuckian with a story to tell, part of our series Humans of Central Appalachia. Interview audio provided by Malcolm Wilson.
I'm just living my life, all eyes on me. I got a pocket full of cash, still ride like a Jeep.
Back in a moment with more selections from our series Humans of Central Appalachia. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
I'm just living my life, my life, my life.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're back with more of our holiday special selections from our series Humans of Central Appalachia, with interviews provided by Letcher County photographer and videographer Malcolm Wilson. Malcolm gathered the stories of people in eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, and northern Tennessee. Appalachians have a deep and abiding sense of place, and we find that if you listen closely to their stories, you hear something of yourself in them. And that brings us to
Katina Haynes. I live in Cumberland, Kentucky.
In her day job, Katina Haynes is the CEO of the Kaywood Ledford Boys and Girls Club in Harlan, and she's very devoted to her work. But this story goes deeper. It's about roots, deep ones.
I live in now the same house I grew up in and the same house that my father was literally born in, and it's been in our family since 1921.
So how would you describe that? What was it like growing up in the mountains?
Growing up in the mountains was a very comfortable experience. Everyone knew each other. You know, you could rely on your neighbors and your friends, and whenever someone died, you took them food, and everyone just looked out for each other and took care of each other, and you didn't have to worry. And I played out on the streets until dark. I rode my bicycle for miles and miles, and my parents never worried that anything would happen to me. I knew I was taken care of.
Life was good, even when you take into account the occasional traumatic experience.
My grandmother bought me chickens for Easter, and we had a little outbuilding, and these chickens, you know, we didn't live on a farm, I lived in town, but these chickens, we raised them in this outbuilding, and I named them, and I went outside every day to feed them, and being a townie, I guess I never made the correlation of where my food came from, and one day I went outside to feed my chickens, and they were gone. And as I said, my granny lived across the yard from me, and I looked in the window, and there's my little frail, tiny grandma with a chicken, holding on to a chicken, wringing its neck, just like, you know. And we had chicken that night for supper, but I went about, I don't know, 6 years without eating chicken again after that.
Katina was close to her grandmother, who was Old Regular Baptist.
If you're not familiar with Old Regular Baptist religion, like, it's really, it is truly Appalachian, and just a huge part of Appalachia and my growing up. But they start services at about 10 o'clock in the morning and go until about 2 o'clock in the evening, and they have 7 or 8 preachers, and, you know, it's hellfire and brimstone, and they're full of energy, and you know, they have handkerchiefs to wipe the sweat off just because they're, you know, I mean, they have to tag team the preaching. It's so intense. And I'd go to church with her, and they'd have foot washings, and everybody would just wash each other's feet. And I think that's really indicative of Appalachia, because that's what you do for each other. I mean, you're not afraid to get down and help each other on whatever level. And then there would be dinner on the ground, and it was just, you know, all of these Appalachian cooks brought all these wonderful dishes, and we would eat and feast and fellowship with each other.
Years passed, people kept saying, there's nothing to do here. You have to get out.
I heard it from other kids. I heard it from adults, you know, adults who lived here. It wasn't ever the people who had left. It was the people who were still here who just kept saying, there's nothing here. There's nothing here for you. You need to go.
So Katina left for Danville and Center College.
I had a government professor, and the very first day of class in government, he started talking about Eastern Kentucky and Harlan County and saying that it was the third world of the United States. And he would talk about, he said there are, you know, tour buses that take people to Harlan County to look at the poverty. And, you know, I don't know if he never had a student from Harlan County or what, but I was absolutely floored. And, you know, my little hand went straight up, and I said, excuse me, I live in Harlan County, and I, you know, I don't recall ever seeing tour buses of people coming in to view the poverty. And that was my first experience of how other people viewed us. And you know, how heartbreaking when you come from a family that you love and a community that you love, and to go somewhere else and just know that people have this really terrible view of you. And I have a master's degree. My husband has a master's degree. He's a librarian. You know, we're educated. We have plumbing and windows and you know, floors in our homes. And just for people to generalize an entire community and kind of discount them as a whole because they view them as uneducated and impoverished is really disheartening.
During those years, Katina often felt that tug of home, and often, whenever she could, made the 2.5-hour trek back to Harlan County. And to something that we hear time and again from the people of Appalachia who have left and returned.
It was like a hug. It was like, you know, there's mountains all around, and it's just comforting and just, you know, kind of cradling me in a way.
It turns out that, like many of us, for Katina Haynes, being in the middle of nowhere is being very much in the middle of somewhere. And that thing that she had once heard so often about getting out of Harlan and finding a life in the city.
Now that I'm back here, I think, where did they come up with that at? Why is that the mindset? Because there's all kinds of stuff to do here. And I get really angry and aggravated when people say there's nothing for kids to do here. Because there's so much to do, because we just have a huge playground. We have God's playground here. There are mountains and streams and hiking trails and plenty of places to bike and explore. And it just saddens me when people say there's nothing to do here.
So, besides the mountains and the less manic pace of daily life, what is it about Appalachia?
It's just a love and a respect and a sense of community and a sense of family that everyone here, even if you don't know that person, you're still somehow connected to them. You have like this magical connection to other people in Appalachia.
There's this one event in particular that, when it happens, makes everyone pause for a moment in a very real display of that thoughtfulness.
Around here, when someone dies, anywhere, you know, in Harlan County or Eastern Kentucky, you don't have to know that person. If you're driving down the road and there's a funeral procession coming by, you pull off the road. You just pull off the road out of respect until the procession is over. And, you know, when I'm somewhere else and there's a funeral procession and people are buzzing by, like, that's so unnatural for me, you know, just to not show that kind of respect to someone.
It's a little-known side of Appalachian life, and the fact that it is unrecognized is something that Katina can't quite shake.
I think what drives me crazy is when the media comes in and they don't do an equal representation of what's going on in Appalachia.
So what if she could take charge of a network news operation? What would Katina Haynes do?
A few years ago, Diane Sawyer came in and did this really dirty expose of Eastern Kentucky, and there was no positivity to it at all. It was all negative, and the people that she interviewed, I mean, it was like she went out and looked for these people. And I'm not saying that these folks don't exist. There are toothless people in Appalachia, and there are toothless people everywhere, and you can find them if you look for them. But she didn't go and, you know, we have neighborhoods with million-dollar homes in them, and we have a lot of wealth here, and we have a lot of intelligence here, and that is underrepresented. And I think that if I had control of a major news network, I would go into the neighborhoods and show these homes and interview, you know, the doctors and the attorneys and the professionals in Appalachia and just try to do a equal representation across the board.
Katina Haynes has been with the Boys and Girls Club of Harlan for 15 years now. She's seen a lot. There was a year not too long ago when 20% of the kids coming to the club were from homes where both parents had died of drug overdoses. She says it's gotten a lot better since then. She and her staff have been doing a lot of educating about opioids and teaching kids that prescription drugs can be as harmful as they are helpful. It's part of the Smart Moves program of the Boys and Girls Club of America. It's hard work, but good work.
I think I just want to pass on what my parents passed on to me, is that you take care of each other and you take care of the earth that you're on, and that's the legacy that I want to leave, is just a love of art and a love of nature and love for each other.
If you'd like to take a peek at what Katina's up to these days, go online to I Am The Proof. That's all one word, IamTheProof.club. Katina Haynes of Harlan, Kentucky. Now we venture over the state line into West Virginia, about a three-hour drive from Huntington, near the West Virginia border with Virginia, and a conversation with William Buck Wade.
I was born in West Virginia. I was born down at Ekman, where I grew up at.
This was the 1930s. Memories were still fresh of one of the most protracted and violent episodes of civil strife and armed insurrection in this country's history since the Civil War. The scene was the desolate, rugged terrain of the southern West Virginia coal fields, and the issue was the right of miners to belong to a union. In the middle of it all, the coal mining town of Ekman, population 700.
That was a pretty good crowd for then. Nobody lived around in that area but coal miners and their families.
Those families included Buck Wade's mother and father, who had been eking out a living as farmers in North Carolina, and his uncle and cousin, who had made their way to Ekman from Martinsville, Virginia, a trek of 150 miles.
They walked all the way here. They traveled mostly in the day, and they slept at night in the mountain. And it took them 2 weeks.
Work in the coal mines was the attraction. It paid well, at least more than the living they were able to scratch out of the earth as farmers. If you were willing and able, the mining companies would put you to work.
They worked one-leg people. They worked young boys.
Over the years, Buckway developed a theory about this.
I was told this. I don't know how true it was, but I believe it. They say when they first start to bring in blacksmiths, first start to go in the mines, say the companies want to bring them out. The union had just started to get organized. So the companies figured that if the whites struck, they could get the blacks to keep working. So they put the word out everywhere that they were hiring, and that may be how it got down in Virginia, down in North Carolina, down in there where my dad and them come from.
More on this later. By the time he was 12 years old, Wade knew he would be following in his father's footsteps, literally, into the mine, working alongside his dad.
He determined I was left-handed because I picked the shovel up with the left hand. I pushed it with my right hand, but I picked it up with my left hand. And he said, you get over there on the other side. You get over there on the right side. I said, but you said I'm left-handed. He said, you're going to learn how to shovel both ways today for the shift over. Yeah. You're going to know how to shovel both ways. Yeah. left-handed and right-handed. Yeah. So you start off right now, get over there and shovel with your right hand. Well, now, first when I went to shoveling, it seemed like I was shoveling crossways. Yeah. But when you really get used to it, you can shovel like this, and you get a little tired, you can switch over to this way. You get tired shoveling right-handed, you can switch hands and shovel left-handed. That way you can don't have to stop to rest yourself. Because what gets tired is mostly is the hand that picks up the shovel full of coal. And the shovel is I'd hate to show you one of them because they're so big.
Seems like mighty hard work.
It wasn't easy, but it really wasn't backbreaking like you might think.
Wade's mother died when he was young, leaving him with his father and his brothers and sisters.
My father taught me how to comb my sisters and them hair and get them ready for school. He taught me how to cook, taught me how to wash, iron, keep the house clean, see after the children. He taught me and my brother that. And me and my brother and my daddy, we raised the two girls and the one other boy. It was three of us boys and two girls. We raised them. My father taught me how to cook as good as any woman. He could cook. He could do just about anything, little minor things about the house and about working, you know.
This was back in the era of the company town, the company store, 10 cents for a loaf of bread, soda pop for a nickel, company homes rented for 95 cents a month. Another monthly payment ensured that the town doctor would make a house call if needed, whatever the time of day or night.
The doctor bill was 50 cents a month. The hospital, you paid hospital bill back in then, and you paid your hospital bill. And you listed all the children you had or whoever was your dependent. You list that, and you turn that in to the main office who you work for, which was Pocahontas Fuel Coal Company then. And you list all of your dependents or your children and your wife and all. And then they could go to the hospital free of charge. Because you were paying hospital bill. You were paying hospital whether you win or not.
World War II broke out. In 1944, Buck Wade was drafted, sent to the South Pacific, then, after Japan surrendered, to Tokyo.
I was there when they hung Tojo.
The Army trained Wade as a welder. He says he got pretty good at it, but after his discharge, he made his way home to Ekman.
I went back to the mine, yeah, and a lot of the mines had changed over the years. They put a lot of loaders in there that would really load the coal. And they had big machinery, and they had did away with coal loading then. And so I went to running one of the tram motors, they call them, that brought coal out of the mines to the tipper.
It was in those years, the late 40s and early 50s, when Wade started attending meetings of the United Mine Workers Local, the beginning of lifelong loyalty to the union.
The union negotiates a contract where we could get a 10-day vacation, and we'd get $500, $600, $700, $800, $1,000 for vacation pay. Now, that was negotiated by the union, because you can believe this. I don't care how much money a businessman make, if he keep making money, don't you think he gonna wake up one morning and say, "Well, I think I'll go down here and the people working for me have made us so much money. And we've been done so good this year. I think I'm going to go down there and just give them all $1,000 of vacation. Give them 10 days off and pay them." Do you believe one would do that? Huh? I don't care how much money he done made now. He ain't going to voluntarily give you anything.
Wade became a union arbitrator. He worked to settle disputes between company and worker. One thing led to another.
I was the first black to be a member of the United Mine Workers Safety Inspectors.
An African-American coal mine safety inspector, and then a member of the UMW District 17 Executive Board, deep in the mountains of southern West Virginia in the 1950s. Assumptions might be made. Assumptions about blacks and whites just coexisting, not to mention living in harmony, as neighbors, fellow workers, and more.
Some of the best friends that I ever had were white.
And it had been that way for as long as he could remember.
When I was a boy then, they had a big community building down at the, we call it the Pop Stand. It was a train station and everything used to be there. And a lot of the miners used to come there, hang around there, because they sold beer and pop and chewing gum and candy and all that stuff. And a lot of us kids, you know, black and white, we'd hang around there. And they had a petition in it. I remember a petition they had in it. And they said, the white came on this side, the black comes on this side. Now, they didn't have no sign or nothing up in there. But that's what the company told them, you know. Yeah. Now, the president of the local was a fellow named Bob Cawley. And he was a white fella, nice man. He said, this ain't right. He got some of his committees with him. He went to the superintendent. They told the superintendent they wanted him to take that out from in that building. And the superintendent said, are you sure? Told him, say, are you sure? He said, we want it took down. We work together. We going to assemble together. Yeah. They took it down.
And as it turned out, remember that theory Wade mentioned earlier, the company notion that if white miners went on strike, the black miners surely would keep on working?
When the blacks got to working with the whites, when the whites struck, the company was surprised the blacks struck with the whites because the blacks made the same money that the whites made. But when the whites said, well, I ain't going to work no more, I ain't going to work for this, the blacks said, well, I ain't either. So it followed them all off.
Buck Wade retired at 62 and went on to become mayor of the nearby town of Keystone 3 consecutive terms.
And I always won by a large margin when the majority of them was white. Now, that don't spell discrimination to me.
Fond memories? Sledding as a kid? Going to the movies with a dollar he would earn collecting empty bottles to sell to the bootleggers?
Moonshine was great. Yeah.
And then there was basketball and local legends like John Crenshaw.
You know, I seen John jump center and could tap the ball all the way into the basket, standing right there in the center.
Now approaching 90, William Buck Wade still makes his way around McDowell County, West Virginia, in his truck. A lesson learned after 9 decades of life in those mountains, good things don't just fall out of the sky.
I have learned, if you don't ask for something, you won't get nothing. Look at the amount of coal that was mined in McDowell County. They mined more coal taxes, put more tax money down there in Charleston than anybody. What did they get in McDowell County? We didn't get nothing because they didn't go down there and ask for nothing.
William Buck Wade of Keystone, West Virginia. Coming up after the break, we make a stop in the village of Carcassonne, Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to an Eastern Standard Holiday Special on WEKU.
We may not have a cent to pay the rent, but we're gonna make it. We may have to eat beans every day, but we're gonna make it. And if a job is hard to find, and we have to stand in the welfare line.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Let's get back to our holiday retrospective. Another selection from our monthly series, Humans of Central Appalachia, takes us to Carcassonne. Wait, not the stone-walled medieval citadel in the south of France. We're going to a tiny settlement walled by cliffs situated in the southeast of Kentucky, where Letcher, Knott, and Perry counties nudge borders, about midway as the crow flies between Hazard and Whitesburg. We're taken there by photographer-videographer Malcolm Wilson, who has collected the voices of more than 400 people of our region telling its story in their own words.
My name's Mike Caudle, or Michael Caudle.
Michael Caudle was born in Blackie, just down the road from the family home in Carcassonne. When he was very young, not yet two, his folks moved the family from Carcassonne to Richmond, where both his mother and father would earn their master's degrees at Eastern Kentucky University. Now, this was back in the 50s. Soon after graduation, they landed teaching jobs in Owensboro. But as just about anybody from the region will tell you,
Eastern Kentucky has a powerful draw on its natives.
And home always beckoned.
We would be back here probably four or five times a year. Yeah. And from Owensboro, that was a nine-hour drive. You'd take a chunk of a roll of bologna and some bread and make sandwiches on the way. Very rarely did you stop. When my parents were in college, Dad and us boys would go out and find pop bottles for the deposit. And when we saved enough pop bottles to pay for the gas back, then we would fill the tank and head home.
Pop bottles in those days had a value of 3 cents apiece. Gasoline sold for about 25 cents a gallon. There were many of these trips.
If we were coming back in the spring, you could always tell that it was getting close to gardening time because you would see this red line of fire around the hills where people had burned off their gardens and let it get out into the woods, and they were burning the leaves through the woods, and you could smell the wood smoke and the leaf smoke for miles and miles.
Time passed. Mike got married to his wife, Marcia, also in Eastern Kentucky, and born with that powerful homing instinct. And in 1973, they made their way back to Carcassonne.
We've lived in the same house since then, but our address has changed five times thanks to the post office.
Education runs in Mike Caudle's family. Back in 1923, if you lived in or near Carcassonne, as his grandparents did, and if you wanted to go to high school, it meant a difficult trek or even leaving home.
You had to go off to Berea or live in Whitesburg, or it was possible that you could go to the boarding school at Stuart Robinson, but then most of the folks in this area, immediate area, were Old Regular Baptist, and Stuart Robinson was Presbyterian school. I don't know how much that played into it, but it probably played some part.
Mike Caudle's teacher grandfather, Hendrix D. Caudle Sr., had something of an epiphany. Kids in that very isolated neck of the woods, they needed a school.
He is the one who founded Carcassonne School. He took a job building the road that you traveled this morning from Blackie to here. But I think he made $5,000 for that, took the bid on it. And he used that $5,000 to purchase a sawmill, and then he sawed trees off of his own land and some of the trees left over from where the mines did not use them for their timbers. Mm-hmm. And he used that lumber to build the original Carcassonne School.
It was an all-hands-on-deck effort.
I kind of picture it like the Noah's neighbors watching him build the ark. Only Noah's neighbors didn't pitch in and help, and the Carcassonne community did.
After a whole lot of sawing, hammering, and sweat,
the Carcassonne School opened for classes in July of 1924. The original building burned down in the late 20s, sometime in 1929. The building that is there now, you can look at the cornerstone, and it was built in 1930-31, sometime in that period.
This was not just a single one-room schoolhouse. This was a campus in the mountains.
I always have to think about this because I'm not sure. It either covered 40 acres and had 20 buildings, or 20 acres and had 40 buildings. And I'm leaning toward the 20 acres and 40 buildings because if they were counting buildings, they would also count outhouses. Yeah. The school building itself would have had either two outhouses or three, depending on whether or not they built a separate outhouse for the teacher. The water, there was no water run into the school. The well was about 300 feet up the road, and somebody would have to go draw it in a bucket, and everybody shared the same 10 dipper.
The campus was presided over by a house high on a hill.
That was the house that when the sun was rising in the morning, it would strike that house first.
They called it Sunrise House.
That was more or less the administration house. So when they would have people come in, they've had people from all over. Alice Lloyd helped staff the school. But then they had administrators from New England and the Midwest and so on. And that would be their living quarters. And then you had separate houses for the teachers, for the male teachers and the female teachers. And occasionally you'd get a married couple's teachers, so they would have a house of their own.
But not just any house. You know that thing about giving the shirt off your back to somebody in need? Michael Caudill's grandpa was a very generous man.
When teachers would come here to live, he actually tore off part of his house and took it up there and built a house for them to live in, because by then some of his kids had grown and moved off.
Remember now, these were wood structures.
You know how they spread this old sawdust that's coated with the fragrant rosins and stuff to sweep the floors? Yeah. Basically what they were doing was just building a candle. Yeah. So most of the old buildings had burned down.
But the main school building remained. Things sometimes have a way of coming full circle. Mike Caudill's grandfather started the Carcassonne School. His wife, Marcia, was its last full-time teacher.
My wife took a maternity leave in 1974 when our first son was born. Mm-hmm. And they had a lady drive in the next year to start school. And I think she drove in for a week or two and said, I'm not driving that road every day in the wintertime, and resigned. And so they started busing the kids all out from here out to Letcher then.
The old school is now the Carcassonne Community Center, home to the longest-running community square dance in Kentucky. Carcassonne Community Center chairperson John Henriksen, writing in a 2014 edition of the Mountain Eagle newspaper, said, "Our square dancing is and isn't so special. First, it's more circle than square dancing. It's not clogging or show dancing, but community play party dancing where family, neighbors, and friends, old and new, young and old, have fun trying to do or watch and listen to traditional dance figures, all to wonderful old country music. The peak of our fame came at many Kentucky Folklife Festivals in Frankfort and dancing with hundreds at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival on the Mall in Washington, D.C.
We have our culture of folklore and square dances and stuff, and we tend to not think a whole lot about them, but folks from away from here come in and discover them, and they think they've struck the mother lode.
The Carcassonne Square Dance is now a big part of Apple Shop's annual Seed Time on the Cumberland Festival, happening on the 7th through the 9th of next June. Go to seedtimefestival.org on the web to check out the impressive lineup of performers. And while you're there, click on Mission, and you'll see that the goal of this yearly gathering in Whitesburg is to be a mirror for the mountain people and communities, to remind folks here of our cultural riches and traditions that make this region vibrant and always growing. It's no secret to anybody who makes their home in eastern Kentucky that times have changed.
During my lifetime, but not during the time that I've lived up in here, we've shifted from mainly an underground coal economy to a strip mine economy, and now into a mountaintop removal economy. And, you know, Washington gets blamed a lot for the decrease in the mining jobs, but actually what it is you needed a lot more men to do deep mining than you do to do strip mining, and even less for that for mountaintop removal. For mountaintop removal, you can have a couple of bulldozer operators and a couple of men driving ukes, and you don't need 100 men working underground in three different shifts.
There's been much talk about the region's economic salvation. Bring in broadband. Find ways to persuade the young to stay. Attract industry, such as tourism, a notion that plays on the imagination of Mike Caudill. Listen up, Frankfurt.
If it were ever possible, especially if we could ever get a decent road in through here, I'd love to see the community school reestablished with the cabins built back as they were then, right along the immediate area of the school, and have them used as a bed and breakfast, especially on weekends when we have square dances.
Our thanks to Mike Caudill of Carcassonne, Kentucky, and Malcolm Wilson for sharing his Humans of Central Appalachia interviews. Be sure to go to esweku.com and our facts and information page and click on the link to the East Kentucky Food and Dance Trail, put together by Sam Gleaves at the Hyman Settlement School. You'll find more about the Carcassonne Community Center, including info on the monthly traditional mountain square dances they host there between March and November.
Hold it.
Oh, wait a minute. One more thing about teacher and toy maker Mike Caudill.
Those of us who have something to share, we need to share.
And in Mike's case?
When you have trouble losing weight and you don't have any trouble growing a beard and it comes in white and you kind of have a twinkle in your eye, it's a natural calling.
Go to the Humans of Central Appalachia tab on our site, esweku.com, and you'll get the picture. Now, just in case very young ears are near your radio, suffice it to say that Mike once got the ultimate compliment for his seasonal performance.
There's one little girl that has been there the last 3 years, and she, last year, when she came to sit by me, said, "I think you're the real one."
He doesn't do this for money, not even for the thanks he so often hears from so many. He does it for
the look of wonder in their eyes.
From all of us here at WEKU and Eastern Kentucky University, and from a certain bearded, jolly toy maker in Carcassonne, Kentucky,
Merry Christmas to you, and many more.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.